You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story.
My guest this week is the one, the only, Tom Peters, who has been called the Red Bull of management thinkers. And he has embarked on a multi-year Excellence Now campaign. As he notes on his site, these tumultuous times demand deep engagement, human connection, and yes, excellence. In response, Tom has launched his Excellence Now campaign, which includes a trio of tools designed to help you and your team take action. Tom, welcome.
Thank you very much. It is a great delight to be here, Nick. This is stuff I care about. I will begin by saying that if people buy my book and my courses, I will be delighted. I will probably keep the royalties or donate them to something important. But the real truth is that I've written 19 books and they all say the same thing. And so I want you to buy all 19 and I want the royalties from all 19. But, you know, way, way back in 82, when In Search of Excellence came out, everybody was paying attention to the numbers and the spreadsheets and so on. And we said, there's this interesting little group of people involved in your organization called humans. Pay a little attention to them. And if you followed the next 18 books, including this one, same deal. And, you know, my greatest frustration is why something that does not require an above freezing IQ seems to be so difficult to so many people.
Well, I think
all of that, by the way, relative to the book we are here to talk about, it's hell, but relative to the message, it was the definition of serendipity. A fairly decent first draft of the book had been written as of about March 1st, 2020. And we know what happened on March 1st, 2020. And the messages of the last 30 or 40 years take on an urgency and an importance which they had never had before. And now I'm part of a group that may well include you that spends a lot of time with my fingers crossed, because some of the good things that we have done, I hope, will stick and we will not revert to a world where some of this thoughtfulness is not as common as it might be.
So one thing that I think is worth pointing out is you talk about your Excellence Now materials is that a book is definitely the centerpiece, but there's several pieces that go into this as well. There's an additional ebook, a course. So it's an ecosystem of excellence.
Well, to your
point. Is that a thing?
It's in many respects, the one that excites me the most is the course. I've done it before. And we've gotten the first part of it approved by Udemy, so we're real now and gotten some good early reviews. But it is a program that consists of 6 courses, topics like excellence, innovation, people, and so on. There are 99 steps in the full 6 programs. There are 99 short 2 or 3 minute explanatory videos that I do. And then we decided to do another 99, which are hyper short ones that we call TTDN, which stands for things to do now. And so this is new turf for me, and I am incredibly excited. We've been working on this thing for 2 years and we're just starting the release now. It's not half bad. I mean, because of my incredibly old age, among other things. I'm a print person. I've made this totally sarcastic remark about TED Talks. I've said 17 minutes, you speak at 130 words per minute. Therefore, it is about 2,200 words. Send me the 2,200 word page with all the arm waving. A little too much cynicism, which I would even acknowledge, but whatever.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, too, the pretty good first draft about a year ago. That was around the time at the beginning of all of this. And we actually spoke then, not about this project, but did that, that timing fascinates me just because this is, I mean, easily, I think you mentioned last year, it's the this, you know, at that time, I think you said these few months, but it's ended up, of course, being right. Being the whole year has been a point like no other in business. So did that first draft change, or knowing you and your approach of humanism, did the volume just get turned up?
The volume got turned up by and large. I refuse to say the words that came to mind relative to the message I care about in a way that please, 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 nobody who's watching us take this inappropriately. It was a godsend because it allowed me to really amplify, you know, the basic message. And a lot of words did change. Big ideas fundamentally stayed the same. I mean, the story of why you and I spoke is my wife is a community organizer. She had her own home furnishings company, but she started out as a tapestry weaver. And in those early days, I think we all remember, everybody and their brother was trying to sew masks together. And is that your dog or mine?
Mine.
Great. Fabulous. That makes my day. That's fabulous. That makes this whole thing worthwhile. At any rate, so Susan, who's used to doing incredibly sophisticated tapestry that she learned, or weaving that she learned in Sweden, said, you know, I got to do some of this. And so Susan starts churning out masks. And I'm sitting around and I'm thinking, my God, my wife is busily churning out masks. The world has gone to hell in a handbasket. And my main contribution is to sit on my ass shaking my head. And so my good colleague, Shelley, who you well know, who has worked with me for 20 years, I said, Shelley, I'm going to be arrogant and say that maybe I have a little something that I would like to say that would be consistent with leading in the times of COVID-19. And let's see if we can find some suckers who will let me talk about it. I mean, people like you. We said, you know,
I am that sucker, sir.
Absolutely. We said, look, let's look for this as an opportunity to, you know, to do it. And I'm going to tell you what we did in a way, but I'm going to use your dog. Okay.
Please.
I have shepherds, and the only difference with my 63 pounder would be he would have made the noise and then knocked me out of the chair. And assuming I didn't land on my head, we might have been able to recoup. But here's the deal. And I saw the video of it. Tom Peters doing his thing, national news. And Tom Peters, many, 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 many years ago, Tom's three-year-old runs into the room screaming and shouting like that puppy dog. Tom, after all, I'm the man doing the news, does this in a way that you can see it. I push Joey or Janie back visibly. I don't hurt them. Don't throw them through the wall. Now, Nick, who's giving the national news, has precisely the same thing happened to him, but Nick instinctively, not for the sake of television, picks up little Janie, holds her up and says, hey, be part of the show. Now you are going to have to go. But and what I've said about that, maybe forever, Nick's credibility and humanity relative to Tom is changed approximately forever. You know, because there's no reason in the world that we can't be talking about an international dispute. But when your three-year-old comes in, you get a smile on your face and you pick the three-year-old up. Or do you act like the kid is a nuisance? And it is little touches like that. I mean, the other one I've used as an example is I'm a boss of a 15-person team in a pretty sophisticated business. And we have four or five Zoom meetings a week. And we've now been doing it for X number of weeks. Let's say it's 7 weeks. And you have, God bless you, you have gotten to every meeting on time for those 7 weeks. It's just amazing. Well, the next time when I'm chatting with you online or offline, I say, Nick, I love you dearly, but I'm going to give you a little negative feedback. And the negative feedback is you cannot be in the middle of this and paying appropriate attention to your family and your community and never be late. Productivity is not our principal goal. Do what you need to do. Be late twice a week. Miss three meetings. I said, I'll give you a better performance review as a result of your occasional absences. And I happen to know that you have three kids, and I happen to know that two of them are upstairs homeschooling. And I happen to know, because we've gotten to know each other, that your mom is in a retirement home and not doing perfectly well. Your mom and those kids are 100 times more important than any damn thing that our little 15-person group is going to do. So please. When I talk to people like that, and I'm now talking to the Nick who's watching us, who's a leader, I'm dead serious. This is not a clever idea. It's being humane. It's putting first things first. And the part of it, which of course has also been my message for all these 19 books, is if I treat human being, his productivity is going to go up, his innovation is going to go up, and these things actually, in crude terms, will lead to more growth and more profitability, statistically speaking. But I mean, that's the nice thing about the whole message, is it works. You know, it works on the bottom line. It works for happy customers. It works for happy employees. And the other piece, which is huge, and this was so beautiful, and I read it at least during the pandemic, the great New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote a column from a book of his, and he contrasted what he called resume virtues and eulogy virtues. The resume virtues are, Tom has two engineering degrees from Cornell. He has two business degrees from Stanford. He went to work for McKinsey and Company before they became drug peddlers. He did this, did that, promoted four times by the age of whatever. Those are the resume virtues. The eulogy virtues are what they say about you, God help us both, at our funeral. And at the funeral, they talk about, you know, Nick picking up the kid. They talk about, you know, did she love thy neighbor and help thy neighbor? And all of the human side is what is obviously, I use this PowerPoint slide back in ye olde days when I was in live settings. And it is a picture of a tombstone. And on the tombstone is $11,372,612.17. Nick's net worth when the market closed on the day that he died. And my point is, nobody has ever had a tombstone with their net worth on it.
Right. Well, you talk about the Brooks piece and the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. And way back at the beginning, you said you're talking about the same thing still. And why is it so hard to understand? Is there a disparity? I think there is. Is there a disparity between those two virtues that we aren't getting, especially at work?
Well, the real point is, if we even tried to partially answer that, we'll still be going at this time tomorrow.
Yes.
I mean, think of it in linguistic terms before something that's more practical. think of terms like, which are the standard, right? Now, listen, this is great, wonderful, nice having this conversation, but we've got to get down to business. You know, terms like that, there are a million terms like that, and they all suggest that there's all this real life crap, like the three-year-old kid, and then there's down to business, which means, you know, quit smiling, bend your head down further, type faster, and increase your productivity. And I want to increase your productivity, but as I said, I'm going to do it by treating you decently. But I think that's part of the problem. And I think the sarcastic Tom, who is half honest, says the world would be better off if we closed every business school down. And, you know, when I was at Stanford, I had a wonderful colleague professor, and he said, when they get here, I don't care what their background is, the only damn thing they're interested in are the finance courses and the marketing courses. The courses that deal with human beings, the courses which deal with effective organizations, that's soft stuff. That is cute, but it's not, you know, it ain't spreadsheet generation. And so I think in at least big mid-size or big companies, that's the norm. I mean, you know, one thing that's really important to this discussion and every discussion like this that I have, The Economist invented this term management guru, and I got labeled as one. And so there are a bunch of quote unquote management gurus around. We really are carrying a sin around on our shoulders. And I know I am, but so are most of they. We behave as if the Fortune 500 is the economy. The reality is there's something like 160 or 170 million working Americans when unemployment is down at a more normal low, and the Fortune 500. And the other 93% are not Fortune 500 companies. You know, take one of my most important issues to me, which is more women in leadership positions. There are 12 million women-owned businesses in the United States. And so business is, you know, a riff in the book. And I talk about decommoditization, to use an awful word. And the example I use is a plumber with a 7-person plumbing services company. Well, that plumber has the same opportunity, in my opinion, that Steve Jobs did X number of years ago, to create a magical experience for the customers, to get the job done, to be humane and helpful, to not leave spilled oil on the floor, to show up early, to have a truck that, even though it's in the middle of the winter in Vermont, looks spotless, a whole bunch of things that are about the brand. And the real point is, and damn it, I want to emphasize this, it is as true for that person with that seven person local plumbing company as it is for Ford or General Motors or IBM or Apple. Same ballgame, fundamentally. Same ability to differentiate. I remember it was my last book, not this one. I was trying to get, I had an overdue bill that I just screwed up on. And so I drove 20 miles from home to, this was a guy who had done some engineering services, to his shop. And I drove past at one point, just a standard garden variety place that you see on the road. And it was a little mall as a place where there were 9 or 10 businesses. They were, you know, they went from tailor preparation shop to what have you. And I thought to myself, relative to all these big economic issues, what if each of these 11 companies hired 2 new people in the next 12 months? And then let's multiply that by hundreds of thousands. We add 1 million good jobs to the economy. And it really, the essence of it is, I mean, the guy, we had a broken compressor or a ailing compressor in a Sub-Zero refrigerator that we have. A guy who does run a 5-person appliance repair company came. And we were chatting about this, that day, you know, the like the software and the cars, the refrigerators are becoming smart and everything else are becoming smart. Now, he's not a rich man, but he said to me as we were chatting, I just came back from a 6-day course that I paid for to get a little bit ahead of the curve on these smart machines that I'm now dealing with. And that's a real development effort, in my opinion. And you know, I don't know about you, but I find it easier to get excited about a 7-person local appliance repair company than I do about what's happening in the XYZ division of Ford or General Motors.
Well, and it seems like in the examples that we want to hear about, you mentioned that it was on the management gurus carrying that around, but I also feel like that's sort of what the people value too, mistakenly so, but they want to know that because they're going to think less somehow of that example. And I think that's wrongheaded because of what you can do and the speed at which you can do it, to name a few.
Yeah. Reasons. I mean, I know this is a family show. Instead of wrongheaded, how about ass backwards?
That, yes.
it really is. And well, I just, you go back 20 years ago, and I'm really proud of this. The way it happened is a whole bunch of accidents. I did a public television show that was the first ever in the United States. And it was about middle-sized German companies. They are called the Mittelstand. At that point, which was 20 years ago, China was clearly on the rise and moving fast. Japan was the biggest deal in town along with us. And the number one exporter on the planet, Germans. And it did not come from their giant companies. It came from these middle-sized companies. I mean, one that we talked to, and in fact, my appliance guy, and I can't tell you the details partially because I don't remember, was a chemical company that made something that had to do with coloring candles. And they had 12 employees and a 50% world market share. 7 of the 12 had PhDs, but there was something like through coloring and coloring on the outside, but it was a classic example, you know, planetary superstar with a dozen people on the payroll. And maybe that's not normal, but for you and me, if we go to a town of 11,000, there's the planetary superstar tailor shop, appliance repair person, tax accountant, and so on. And they are to me superstars with a capital S. And you know, the other side of it is, over the long haul, the big companies get worse, not better, period. Some of my old McKinsey colleagues X number of years ago followed the performance of the 1,000 publicly traded companies in the United States. And over a 40-year period, not one of them outperformed the stock market. I mean, you would have thought that the law of large numbers would say somebody snuck in. Well, there was some period where GE had done it for 30 years or Kodak had done it for 30 years, but ain't none of them made it to 40. And I, whenever I'm talking to those giant companies, I said, look, go for it, innovate, have fun. You're on the losing team and life is getting worse every day. You might as well enjoy the show on your way down, which is an infinitely smart ass remark, but there's a grain of truth.
So as we start to think about this and think about wrapping up this conversation, I want to be sure I get to one of my favorite features in your work, the things to do now. Because actually what I love about it is it reminded me of listening to my cassette tapes of the Tom Peters seminar.
Oh, God. Boy, you're much than I thought you were. How are you faking that dark hair?
But I believe each of those sections ended with something similar, with some sort of similar, here's what you should go do now. And that intense focus on action is, first of all, one of my favorite things about your work, because there's there's talk, and then there's doing things, there's getting to work and doing something different than you were before. So when it comes to extreme humanism, what are, I know that there's several throughout all of this, but if there's a big three of things to do now, where does that leave folks?
If you're a boss of a 10-person project team, you really need to know the people you're working with and get to know them. I don't mean prying, but I've said in the past, Nick, if you've been in charge of a 11-person group or something for over 6 months, 11 people, including yourself, if you don't know all the names and ages of the children of those 10 people, you're not on my good guy list. I'm not talking about, you know, some kind of intimacy that I don't believe at all is necessary, but I gotta, and I'm not intruding. I just gotta care about your life.
Yeah.
You know, I said somewhere in the book, and this is a little bit indirect. I said, my definition of an effective manager, and there's only one word in this sentence that's important, someone who is, big word, desperate for each of the 9 people who, quote unquote, reports to him or her to be better when they leave the job a year from now, to be better than when they arrive. I'm desperate for Nick to succeed in some way, to grow. And resume virtues versus eulogy virtues, but my life is a waste. It's a waste. And, you know, I was raised a Presbyterian, but I am not a capital R religious person. I don't darken many church doors. And I always say when I talk about this that, you know, as far as I know, this applies as much to a born and bred atheist as it does to somebody who's a good Catholic who goes to Mass 7 days a week at, you know, 7 a.m. It's just about caring for your fellow, you know, so damn many things we could talk about. One of my favorite little examples in the book is a guy by the name of Peter Miller. He heads a biotech company called Optinose. And it's in my section on hiring. And he said, we only hire nice people. Now, and he then said, which I loved, is he said, look, there are some jobs in a biotech company where you could not even pronounce the name of the degree that the person needs to have. But he said, I found out this big thing. In the world, there are actually a lot of people who have them. Don't hire the jerks. And you know, it's and then what he does in his place, which I loved, is you're Peter, the boss, and I'm this person who's interviewing for an R&D job, basically, with one of those degrees. My background is so incredibly good that you are noticeably standing there, sitting there drooling down out of both sides of your mouth. And I just want to, you know, hand you a pen and have you sign the employment agreement. Well, the deal is that, in fact, the person being interviewed has to do what they call run the gauntlet. And run the gauntlet is 5 or 10 minute conversations with 6 or 7 people. And it can be a 23-year-old in the finance department. It can be the receptionist. It can be some hotshot scientist. And every one of those 6 or 7 people has the right to say, fabulous degree, doesn't work within our culture. And I can ding, any of them can ding me, even though you think I walk on water. And I love that. And you know, I talk a lot about empathy and hiring for empathy. And so many things we could talk about. Google did an analysis of their best employees and all the factors associated with being best employees. We're soft stuff, like listening to one another. I mean, typically, if you're on a Google team, you've got you who are an MIT graduate with an IQ of 473. I am a Stanford graduate, not doing so well. My IQ is only 472. And fundamentally, we are the most arrogant bastards God ever put on earth. The word listening is not in our vocabulary, et cetera. Well, what they found out was, guess what? They ain't the best employees.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to obviously have a significant IQ to work for Google, but the best employees were the ones who listened, the ones who cared, the ones who respected the ideas of others, the ones who respected the diversity of the group, and so on. And I love it, because if it can happen at Google, it ought to happen anywhere.
That is that is great. And that makes me think of one of my favorite quotes of yours that I went back and wrote down before I knew we were going to chat today. The old hard is soft and soft is hard. And I think more true than ever.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, the numbers, the plans, and the organization charts are abstractions, which are infinitely easy to manipulate. And the hard stuff is that Nick and I have had a 11-year relationship, and we depend on each other like two guys climbing Mount Everest or El Capitan in California. That's hard.
Yeah.
The other stuff, I mean, when it was really easy to write about that was during the crash of 06, where, of course, we had had derivatives of derivatives of derivatives. And so it all looked gorgeous on the spreadsheet. And excuse the language, underneath it was all shit.
Like as you've said a few times, there's all sorts of different ways we could go and different questions that I could ask. But it is time for me to ask you, for a brand or business that has made you smile recently.
I live in a town called Dartmouth, Massachusetts, with 30,000 people. And there was some complication about some piece of property and zip codes and so on. And I went to the Dartmouth Town Hall. And, you know, they were, and I believe it's characteristic of the whole place, they were just totally decent. You know, we laughed, we smiled, we teased. They got it settled. They did it in a completely professional fashion. But I walked out of there thinking, and I could tell a longer story about these aren't bureaucrats. They're members of my community. And they have a lot of rotten and silly rules that they are required to reinforce, but they didn't write the rules. And, you know, they're the human face of the town. And there are a lot of things I love about my town. But really, the big point to the people who are watching us is these brands that make you smile can be the tax collection department at the town of Dartmouth as much as they can be some sexy thing that you see somewhere. And that's a brand. That's a brand. It's human beings. It sets the tone for the whole darn city.
And the operative phrase in all of that that you just said is they can be. They can. And someone there has set a culture that sets all of that into motion and delivered something that was unexpected and amazing from your point of view as a community member.
Yeah. And you know, it's sophisticated stuff and it's paying taxes, but the whole way that they approached the job, the town, me, and they were also magical because there was a line behind me. So we didn't sit and do what I'm doing with you, which is to shoot the shit for the rest of the day. They had to be efficient too. But, I don't say I walked out of there with friends for life, but I walked out of there and thought, this is good. This is good.
That is a great smile. And as you just said, I could shoot the shit with you the rest of the day, but I want to be cognizant of your time. Where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do and Excellence Now?
Well, I'd start with the website, which is hard to remember. It's called tompeters.com.
We should have paused to tell people to go get a pencil. And
and we literally have everything I've done for the last 20 years there. You know, we've got every PowerPoint presentation, which probably is a couple of thousand. We've got, I've done 7 or 8 of these conversations around the release of the new book. We've got the links to every one of those and miscellaneous comments from here and there. We also have another site that's called excellencenow.com. And that includes something, God knows how, I use PowerPoint slides and I used to give thousands of presentations. And it's a 27 chapter, 4,096 slide presentation of everything with about 150,000 words of annotation. And the important point, I live to be stolen from. There is nothing, nothing, nothing in this stuff that is proprietary. This is your marketing and brand too. Our book In Search of Excellence really took off in 82. Publisher didn't have a clue. And so the first print run was 3,000. And this came out of a project of looking at excellent companies that I had done at McKinsey, a nicer McKinsey, as I said. And we had put together something called the Orange Book. And the Orange Book was a paper book. Remember, this is 81 or 82, so there were things like paper. A paper book, and it consisted of about 200 or 300 annotated overhead transparencies with text describing exactly what was going on. We have a 3,000 first print run. And my co-author, Bob Waterman, and I gave away 5,000 copies of what we called the Orange Books. Our publisher wanted to kill us. But I will tell you, and I don't think this is wrong, that was the secret to our success.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, everybody who'd gotten the freebie Orange Book then mm-hmm. said, oh, my God, I'm going to order 37 of those for the finance department. But I really, there was a book. Maybe you talked to the author something years ago called The Gift Economy. And, if there's nothing like giving it away, and we do give it away. I mean, I give it away for primary reasons. It's probably true of an awful lot of people who go through the pain in the ass process of writing a book because I give a shit about the ideas. I'm delighted to collect the royalties. But that's not the point. The point is, are you the TV anchor who picks up the three-year-old or the TV anchor who blows the three-year-old off? And it's, thinking about the big ones is key. I'm, 78, and I said, I have only one judge of my life. And the judge of my life is, can I walk past a mirror and look into the mirror without barfing? have you done your best? And the other thing I also want to say, pragmatic, a TTDN, a to thing to do now, not in some quanti way, but at the end of the day, ask yourself, how was my eulogy virtue score today? When did I take a little extra time to be helpful? When did I do this? When did I do that? And again, I really emphasize this is not capital R religion, even though you and I are doing this thing on Good Friday. This is life. And what I did say when we had that COVID conversation a while back was what you as a leader do during this time of madness. We were talking in terms of 90 days or 120 days. Then we're now a year in, and there is apparently some light at the end. What you do during this time of madness defines your life as an adult professional human being. It's like, I use a quote from a 5-star World War II general by the name of Omar Bradley, and he commanded U.S. troops in the D-Day battle. Here's this amazing human being, but his life is defined by about 48 hours. Yeah. When the shit hit the fan, and how did you react? Did you rise to the occasion? And all this stuff. I mean, I know we don't have forever, but God almighty. Pre-D-Day, The Brits had this high powered, he was like our Patton, Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery. And Montgomery gives a speech to his troops the night before D-Day, and he talks about the glorious mission and the opportunity, you know, which is a slightly big deal when Europe has been overrun by Hitler. Eisenhower, who never wore any medals and had what was called an Eisenhower jacket, Eisenhower goes down to the waterside where these kids, children, are going to be launched in the battle. Honest to God, I've told this story 100 times and I always tear up. And he just walked among the shoulders of the soldiers, 18, the old ones were probably 21, and he put his arm around them and pat him on the shoulder. And probably in 9 cases out of 10, he didn't say a darn thing. And that was Commanding Officer General Eisenhower, who ran the whole show on D-Day. And that was, that's what he did. And that's what he cared about. And, you know, Montgomery did whatever Montgomery did. And God only knows it was helpful. Just like Patton did stuff that was helpful. But Patton was also known for slapping a kid in the face in the field hospital who had gotten scared shitless at a time where anybody reasonable would have gotten scared shitless. But I can just see General Eisenhower on that beach. And nothing that the people who are watching us are doing, including thee and me, is up to the standard of a D-Day battle. But every day we spend with our fellow human beings, and we can contribute to making their life a little bit better, making them a little bit smarter, a little bit more thoughtful, and so on, or not. We can say, let's get down to business. Or we can say, I know your mom's got a problem and, you know, you taking care of her, taking the time you need to take care of her. And that's the General Eisenhower asks, are you taking care of your mom? And, you know, the other guy says, we got to get this PowerPoint out because the presentation's tomorrow morning.
I don't want to know what Patton does if the kid runs into the Zoom meeting. Would not be his finest moment. No. Eisenhower picks the kid up, not Patton.
Absolutely.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. If folks can't remember TomPeters.com, we will link up to everything that we talked about, and including Excellence Now, at onbrandpodcast.com. Tom, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for just the plain old lovely conversation that may have a couple little things that will be helpful to a couple of people. Who knows?
Thanks, Tom. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.